May it please the Court, Joe Murray for the appellant, Heartland Trust Company, the conservator of Loyola Kaiser. Loyola Kaiser, or Loyola and Reuben Botipka, were married in the 1950s and they had two children, James Botipka and Carol Now Harris. Reuben died early on. Loyola married again and married Albert Kaiser. They had one child, Paula Asmus. Albert and Loyola had a long marriage, and in 2005 they did some estate planning, and it was mutual estate planning, related estate planning. They provided for the survivor through the use of life estates and outright devises, very standard things that you would expect a married couple to do. September 15, 2009, Albert paid $200,000 for a single premium annuity and named Loyola as the beneficiary. In 2010, he paid $25,000, paid up a life insurance policy, and named Loyola as the beneficiary. March 19, 2014, Loyola, not yet under guardianship or conservatorship, Albert signs a new will, and he signs a trust. And it provides nothing for Loyola. She is not a devisee under the will. She's not a beneficiary of the trust. She's not even mentioned in either document to even identify or acknowledge that he has this wife. June 12, 2014, Albert signs a deed. Back in 2005, when they did their estate planning, Loyola gave him durable power of attorney. He signs a deed to himself, Loyola's undivided one-half interest and some other land to his trust, which she is not a beneficiary.
Well, that brings up a question.
Excuse me?
That brings up a question I hadn't thought of, but can somebody with the power of attorney make a conveyance to themselves?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that's part of Exhibit 4 in the record, and he is making a conveyance of Loyola Kaiser's property to himself as trustee of this trust, and it's a gratuitous transfer. There's testimony that there was no consideration received, and the document does not permit that.
Right.
How is that legally significant to the issue on appeal?
Well, I just think...
Is this color?
I think it just supports exactly what was going on here. Here she is. He goes out, begins this independent estate planning that does not acknowledge her existence, it does not provide by her, and then he takes this second step and attempts to transfer the land into the trust.
Is there anything in the record telling us what the motivation for this is?
No. There's not, Your Honor.
Who would be the ultimate beneficiary of the actions at that point?
It would be the beneficiaries of Albert Kaiser's trust, Carol Harris, and Paula Asmus. They're the only ones. James Botipka is expressly excluded, and Loyola Kaiser is not mentioned.
So the solution, if Loyola be the survivor, which is what ensued, the solution, if these things had taken place and she, and it was problematic, is the statute for elective share. That gets her back in the game if the will is not favorable. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
So that the availability of elective share can remedy, I'll just call it a problem.
It's essential in this case.
Okay, but now we go on to our specific issue because she becomes a protected person attempting to use an elective share, the object of which is to remedy these things that you've just described. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. I want to point out two more things. Before he died on January 19, 2015, he apparently did two other things. He changed the beneficiary of the single premium annuity and $25,000 life insurance policy and took that out of her the assets that she would otherwise have been entitled to. There's $225,000.
Wasn't he legally obligated or legally able to do that, though? Wasn't he?
Well, apparently under the terms of the policy, as the owner of the policy, he was able to do that.
And do we know where the money came from to buy those policies?
Well, it's in the record, and it just shows him to be the owner to have paid the $200,000 single premium payment.
So we don't know where that money came from?
We don't know where the money came from, no, no.
So as a practical matter, as the trustee, you felt you had a legal obligation to challenge this?
I believe we definitely had a legal obligation to challenge.
And if you didn't, somebody else would be mad at you if you didn't.
That's exactly right.
That's what you have to do.
Plus, my client, Harlan Trust Company, needs to provide for their ward. And let's go to the statutory considerations, because she is under guardianship and conservatorship. We will apply for permission to authority to make the claim. We have a hearing, and it's under advisement for 7 months, during which time our 9-month statute is going to run when we can make the election. So we file a provisional election. You know, and then
so what did the county court judge say about for example, the assets available to your client to
that's
provide for herself, or
one of the statutory considerations, and I think the judge found that there were sufficient assets. However, Your Honor, assets take two forms. There are liquid assets that you can use, and then there are fixed assets, real estate. That was the bulk of this. If you look at one of the exhibits is her budget, a third of her income is from Social Security. The rest is from what we believe is speculative income, farm rent. And it's a tight go. There's not $225,000 in the account that she could draw on. There are no liquid assets. There's no stream of income other than this land that she already had in her own name.
What is the rationale for the court not allowing the spouse to take an elective share? What rationale is there? I mean, that she's got enough and she doesn't need any more? Is that?
I think that's a judge. I mean, I can't answer that. I mean, you look at the other statutory considerations. What about mutual estate plans? We had mutual estate plans, and they were basically destroyed by the independent action.
His actions, in effect, went against the mutual estate plan.
Absolutely, absolutely, blew them up.
And is that a consideration of the statute?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And there is another consideration of the statute. What's the financial effect on the two estates? Well, the financial effect on Albert's by allowing the election would be none, because as a surviving spouse, she paid no tax on what she got, where the kids are going to pay some tax. The financial effect on her estate is it would give her the income that she needs. She is confined to a nursing home. There's nothing else she can do. She has to have funds to live on.
Now, she did have sufficient funds to meet her monthly expenses, didn't she, at that point?
Yes, but as I said, they came from Social Security, and they came from the net farm rent and that.
And she had over $1 million in assets.
Yes, but that was a fixed asset. It was a farm that she'd owned for a long time.
Which generated the income to support her.
Right. Okay.
Do you think that the trial judge misunderstood the statute?
I think that's entirely possible, Your Honor.
What do you think is the meaning of this 302315?
Well,
and have you tried to diagram it?
Yes, I have. And it's certainly difficult. But I mean, when you go through those considerations and you look at the reasonableness of it, I just can't imagine that it is reasonable for a judge to approve a independent estate plan by one spouse who doesn't even mention the other one and who basically disinherits her. I think that's what the elective share is all about. It's to provide for people that cannot protect themselves. She didn't change her will. If she'd have gone first, he would have had what that provided for her.
What's our standard of review on this ruling?
Does the ruling conform with the statute? Is there substantial evidence to support the ruling, and is it unreasonable? That's where we are, and I think that appellant makes it on all counts. It just makes no sense, and the judge could have gone anywhere from up to 50%, which is the share we asked for. and the share which generally you can, if you're not incompetent, you can get automatically. We give her no consent.
Well, how does that affect the analysis?
Well, I think, I don't know, Judge.
If you're not incompetent.
Well, first of all, she was not incompetent at the time he signed the will. It was just later that he became incompetent.
Is it not significant that she, at the time of you all attempting to get approval to seek the election, that she is now a protected person?
It's absolutely significant.
So that's why we find ourselves under this statute.
That is exactly right. But that did not exist when he implemented this state plan on his own.
That she was not a protected person at that time. So do you think that's significant in the analysis?
Just because of that, there's a Clarkson case which is cited which says when a person signs a will, they're presumed to know that they cannot disinherit their spouse and that the statutory right would trump it.
Are you relying on Clarkson for a statutory interpretation?
Well, I really can't because that was decided prior to the implementation of the probate, of the new probate code. But it was still something that required, if you were under guardianship, they appointed a guardian ad litem for you, and that person did an investigation and reported back to the court. So there was still something you had to go through.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bixby, good morning to you.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Paul Bixby of Bixby Law Office. I am the representative for the appellee and interested party, Paula Asmus and Carol Harris. We ask that the Supreme Court affirm the order of the lower court as there were no errors on the record and the decision was not arbitrary, capricious, nor unreasonable. The court
is there. Is there a factor of equity in this?
I do not believe so.
So would you mind to recite what you believe the standard of review is then?
The standard of review in probate matters are errors on the record and that the decision conforms to the facts and it's not arbitrary, capricious, nor unreasonable.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what happened in between March to July of 2014? What prompted all this? Why did Albert change his will? Why was the conservatorship established? Something's going on in that story, but we don't know what it is. Can you tell us?
I wish I could, but I don't know what was going on. Some estate planning was going on, more or less. But I don't mean to sound rude to the court, but that's not something the statute looks at, of what was going on before.
Is there anything in the record as to what was going on?
The things in the record are there is a new will and trust established by Albert Kaiser, the deceased, and a annuity and life insurance policy. The beneficiary was changed.
Is there anything in the record about where James stands on things, such as his rent?
There was a semi-separate proceeding that was going on during this where Mr. Vititka had not been paying his mother rent on the farm he farmed that she owned. So he owed her, the protected person, some back rent. And so he settled with the court and the conservator got those funds.
So what's driving this case?
That the conservator may or may not have an obligation for a protected person to make this election. There's also a driving force that one son, James Vititka, is using the conservator to challenge this to get a larger share of the estate of his mother, as he was not included in his stepfather's estate plan.
And that's the conservator. Is that correct? Is James's potential inheritance from his mother?
Yes, because he gets one-third of everything his mother would get under the will currently of Albert, his stepfather, he gets nothing. So if the court exercised the election, he would get a bigger share.
The conservator indicated some prudent reasons for going forward, seeking funds on behalf of its ward, right, and filing for the elected chair even though there was no determination of this one. You don't quarrel with that?
No, that is... Okay. Okay. So the court ground their decision in factors that are found specifically in the statute in question, which is 30-23-15, not an old statute, 30-108, but 23-15. He grounded his decisions in age. The protected person is 88 years old, or was last summer, and is in declining health as she was on hospice. Assets. The protected person has over $1 million assets. The statute does not contemplate what type of asset, only assets. There's no determination in any of the many words for the court to consider of liquid or static or real estate assets. Just
well, if she, were competent, she could get... She could exercise as a matter of right that 50% elective share. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
How does that figure into this equation?
The legislature, in their great wisdom, decided that protected persons do not have that right, that a court has the right to determine if they get the elective share or not.
Well, it might be different if the protected person, by taking an elective share, had no relatives in which to leave that property, and thus it would become intestate and the property goes to the state of Nebraska because there are no legal heirs that would take the property. But in this case, she has legal heirs that would take the property under her right to exercise the elective share. Why isn't that an unfair situation where the court says, well, I'm not going to let you take that elective share because you're not going to get this property that you normally would get if your mother died or if your mother were competent. But since she's now incompetent, you can't exercise that right.
I think the statute makes...
I mean, what the thing is you're transferring assets from one person to another that are both... in some respects, related to all of the parties.
Yes.
Is it a proper consideration under the statute to take into account what the heirs of the protected person would take?
It is one of the many considerations in the protected person, the estate of the protected person, inheritance, succession. The statute contemplates everything. It's the best interest of the protected person and...
I beg your pardon, the best interest during her lifetime?
During her probable lifetime. And of the children.
Well, why isn't it in the interest of the protected person to have as many assets as she can during her lifetime? What's adverse to her interest there?
There are two views on the subject.
Yeah.
And it was surprising to me how long this has been a problem, that the current Nebraska statute is the majority view, that best interest does not necessarily equate with most money.
What makes you say that with respect to this statute? Have you seen a statute like this elsewhere?
There are current statutes similar to this that have been decided. The court in the Clarkson case even said that their reading of the Clarkson case was Nebraska was going to follow the minority.
That was under the old statute.
Correct. So
no,
this,
I'm not talking about the current statute that we're asked to apply, 30-23-15. Are
yes.
you aware of other states that have a statute comparable to this?
Yes. I believe
and what
Colorado,
states are those? Pardon me.
Colorado, I believe Minnesota, are states in this majority view.
But if Minnesota followed the UPC, then it wouldn't be similar to ours. Is that correct?
That could be correct.
Ours is not the UPC. Is that correct? Okay. So the question was, who else has a statute like this?
That I cannot tell you.
All right. Thank you.
But our contention is this is similar to other statutes that are in this majority view that have found that best interest does not equate to most assets, but equates to you have to look at the whole picture.
Well, if we looked at the whole picture, Which action would more conform to the party's original estate planning back in 2005? Or election of the statutory share, or allowing the husband to change his will and make different transfers that were different, favoring his heirs as opposed to hers in changing the transfers that they made during the 2005 will?
The 2005 will, it would conform to exercising the right of election. But as this court knows, everybody is free to make a new will whenever they want.
Doesn't that in some cases encourage undue influence on the parties by the beneficiaries of the estates?
You could see that, yes. The statute looks at mutual estate plans, but it also looks at dependent estate plans. And that's what the county court found, that there is a valid dependent estate plan by the decedent where he wanted to shift assets away from a stepson that had fallen out of favor with him, who hadn't been paying farm rent, to his spouse, and give them to his only heir and a stepdaughter.
That's part of the record?
Yes.
Okay. So,
did the county court give any relevance to the fact that Albert changed the beneficiaries on these two policies to remove Loyola as the beneficiary?
There was only... Nobody knows where policies went. There's nothing in the record.
Well, we know where they didn't go.
Correct.
We know they didn't go to Loyola.
Correct.
Does the county court make any reference to that in its
order? Their decision, they do not. So the county court looked at the age. My time is up. We ask that you affirm the decision of the lower court as it conforms to the record, is not arbitrary, capricious, nor unreasonable. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
He is over.
There is no time for rebuttal. On we go then to the next case of the day, which is In Re Estate of Evertson. Justice Kelch is recused in this matter. Is it Mr. Wolf?